This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah. وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Plows into a crowd during a Christmas parade in the U.S. city of Waukesha, leaving at least five people dead and dozens more injured. Unrest hits the Netherlands for the third consecutive night amid public anger at the government's coronavirus restrictions. Chile is headed for a presidential election runoff between far-right candidate José Antonio Castro led the first round and leftist politician Gabriel Boric. My name is Arash Zahidi. Welcome. A car ramming incident during a holiday parade in the U.S. state of Wisconsin has left five people dead. The incident happened in the city of Waukesha, west of Milwaukee. Police said over 40 people were also injured, but the numbers could be revised. A video posted on social media showed a red SUV speeding toward marchers taking part in the city's Christmas parade. It sped off after mowing them down. Police say the vehicle involved has been recovered and one person of interest is in custody as investigations continue.
An officer did discharge his weapon at the suspect vehicle to try to stop the vehicle. No bystanders were injured as a result of the weapon discharge. We're no longer looking for a suspect vehicle. We do have a person of interest in custody at the moment, but this is still a very fluid investigation.
It is still unclear what the potential motive was or if the incident was related to terrorism. However, a shelter-in-place order issued after the incident in the city has been lifted. Waukesha's schools and roads will remain closed on Monday, and officials said the White House is closely monitoring the situation in the city. We will continue to bring you updates on that story as they come in. Protests against coronavirus restrictions continue across the Netherlands for the third consecutive night. Police say 130 people have so far been arrested. A flashpoint was the city of Enschede, where an emergency order is in place. The protests saw police clash with angry people who set off fireworks and vandalized properties. However, authorities say Sunday night's unrest was less violent than the past two nights. Previous night, police resorted to water cannons to disperse protesters in The Hague. Several officers were injured there. Also on Friday, four people were killed by police live fire in Rotterdam. Demonstrations center around the new COVID restrictions, including a potential mandatory vaccination for access to indoor venues. Our third headline story, Chile is headed for a presidential election runoff after the two leading candidates fell short of a majority needed for an outright win. Far-right former Congressman José Antonio Kast led the first round with nearly 28% of the ballots. His leftist rival, Gabriel Boric, secured nearly 26%. The two will face again in the December the 11th vote. Sunday's ballot comes after 2 years of protest by Chileans who were demanding better life conditions. The protesters also demanded constitutional reforms. They will be drafted under the next president. Seats in the Chamber of Deputies and almost two-thirds of Senate seats were also at stake. Our man in the Chilean capital, Santiago, has given us the latest on the general election there.
We saw many people voting today, yet only 45% of those eligible to vote actually cast their vote, their ballots at the poll station. So this is a record low for presidential elections, and that those who didn't go to vote were people who got disappointed, disillusioned with the politics that was being done from the Congress, from the parties, and other powers that be. And this is part of a more complex social and political battle in the country.
Meanwhile, the initial results of the regional elections in Venezuela are out, with the ruling United Socialist Party scoring a major victory. Venezuela's election authority says the party has won the mayorship of the capital, Caracas, and 20 governorships, while the opposition has won only three. President Nicolas Maduro says the win was impressive. Nearly 42% of eligible voters turned out for the Sunday ballot to pick over 3,000 state governors, mayors, and city councilors across the country. The votes saw the opposition politicians return to the electoral fray after 3 years of boycott on elections. Our correspondent Camila Escalante joined us earlier to give us a picture of how top Venezuelan officials are reacting to the outcome of the weekend's regional elections.
Well, Nicolas Maduro says that this is, of course, a victory for Chavismo. He says that he convoked the bases of the PSUV to go out and cast their ballots and show support for the most powerful, influential political organization in the country, and they did so. Nicolas Maduro, who just came on air just a bit ago, said that we beat Chile. Chile held presidential elections, and they had a lower turnout than Venezuela, which only, of course, received 42% of the turnout. So this just comes to show that in a race where normally you get low turnout, they got even lower turnout.
Things seem to be settling down in Sudan. Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, who's reinstated by the military after last month's coup, says he's been granted complete freedom to form a government of technocrats. Hamdok reportedly made a remark hours after inking a political deal with the military. Reports say the two sides also agreed to hold elections by July 2023. Earlier on Sunday, the country's military reinstated Hamdok and promised to release all political prisoners. Premier said it agreed to the deal to stop the bloodshed, but the opposition and trade unions have voiced opposition to the agreement. They're demanding a full civilian rule in Sudan. The development comes after weeks of deadly unrest triggered by the October the 25th coup. More than 40 protesters have been killed in the military's crackdown since then. Political commentator Mr. Jonathan Ofei Ansa says it is unlikely the military will completely disengage itself from Sudan's politics.
I am not very sure. Though on paper he's going to be given a free hand, in reality, I doubt if the military is going to give me a free hand, because most the demand of the civilian protesters has been, you know, for the military to totally disengage from the country's political terrain, and this they haven't done. They are still part of the transitional government, so I'm not sure that Abdullah Hamdok is going to have 100% control. I do admire, you know, the resolve of the Sudanese people. We mustn't forget that it was largely through their persistent protest that led to the overthrow of the former president, Al-Bashir, 2 years ago, and they are determined. I think the people of Sudan must have taken their cue from the Arab Spring, which was largely successful. And I believe they are not going to give in until, you know, they see their demands met fully.
Yemen's army has successfully hit several targets in Saudi Arabia, including Aramco refineries in Jeddah. The operation comes in retaliation for the kingdom's ongoing aggression against Yemen.
Yemen's armed forces carried out another massive retaliatory attack against several targets in Saudi Arabia using 14 drones. The targets included Aramco refineries in Jeddah, as well as several military sites in Riyadh, Abha, Jizan, and Najran.
In response to the escalation of the Saudi-led aggression and its crimes and siege, our armed forces conducted the 8th operation codenamed Balance of Deterrence by bombing several military and vital targets of the Saudi enemy. The armed forces have proven their ability to carry out more offensive operations against the Saudi and Emirati enemy within the legitimate defense of our people and homeland.
Experts say this operation comes in response to Riyadh's recent escalation in Marib and the fresh air strikes that killed civilians, including children, in Hodeidah and other cities.
This large-scale operation came amid the ongoing aggression and in response to the recent Saudi escalation. Saudi-led coalition is trying to pressure our forces to stop their progress towards the city of Marib by targeting civilians, and this prompted the Yemeni army leadership to accelerate the implementation of major operations deep inside the kingdom.
Recently, the Saudi-led coalition has escalated its airstrikes across Yemen and killed more civilians, including children. However, Yemen's military has vowed to hit back at those killing Yemeni civilians.
The Yemeni army has given a stern warning to the Emirati regime, saying it is capable of expanding the range of its attacks to include targets deep inside Emirati territories. Yemeni say their army should continue its operations until the war is stopped.
Inmates have escaped en masse from a crowded old prison in the Western Democratic Republic of the Congo. Britain's decision to blacklist Palestinian resistance movement Hamas as a terrorist organization is sparking outrage and condemnation around the world. The move, which will be pushed in the UK Parliament next week, could see Hamas supporters and activists face jail terms of up to 14 years.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is now designated as a terrorist organization by Britain following the Friday announcement of UK Home Secretary Priti Patel. The move brings Britain in line with the United States, which designated Hamas a terrorist group in 1995, and the European Union. UK Home Secretary Priti Patel justified the decision by arguing that it was not possible to distinguish Hamas's political and military wings. She claimed that Hamas has a significant terrorist capability and access to extensive and sophisticated weaponry. This is while the group uses its weapons to defend the Gaza Strip against Israeli aggression. Patel also highlighted the importance of a ban to protect the Jewish community. The British official, however, did not make any reference to Israel's deadly attacks against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The British Parliament will vote on the proposals next week. If Patel's bid succeeds, showing support for Hamas in Britain could be punished with up to 14 years in prison. Israel applauded the news, with its foreign minister, Yair Lapid, saying the move was a result of joint efforts between the British and Israeli regimes.
And, of course, it was all in cahoots with Washington as well, apparently. The British Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who announced this decision, made the announcement in Washington, not even in London. So you can see the Israelis, the British, and the Americans were all involved in this.
The London's decision adds the political wing of Hamas to an existing ban on the movement's military wing, Al-Qassam Brigades. This move has drawn widespread condemnation. The Palestinian Authority says the UK took the measures at Israel's request, adding that it's an unjustified aggression against the Palestinians and will hamper reconstruction efforts in the besieged Gaza Strip. Iran has also denounced the British measures. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the Palestinians' rights cannot be trampled on by distorting facts. Hamas has slammed the UK's move as a crime against the Palestinian people.
The British Home Office's decision to consider Hamas a terrorist organization is a crime against our Palestinian people and all their history of a struggle, as well as a condemnation of the legitimate struggles of all free peoples against colonialism. This decision, if implemented, is considered a great political, moral, and legal sin committed by Britain, in addition to its first crime of establishing the Zionist entity and making the Balfour Declaration.
Hamas's spokesman said Britain's move encourages the Israeli regime to continue its atrocities against Palestinians.
Britain's move to brand Hamas a terrorist organization coincides with the anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. For more than a century, Palestinians have been subjected to the most heinous forms of occupation and historical injustice as a result of that statement from the British government, which makes it responsible for Israel's takeover of Palestinian land.
The Balfour Declaration was a public statement issued by the British government in 1917 during the First World War, which laid the foundations for the entity of Israel. The declaration is seen as a catalyst for the 1948 Nakba, where more than 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from their homes. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates condemned the ban on Hamas, describing the move as an unjustified attack on Palestinians who have been subjected to the most heinous forms of occupation and historical injustice as a result of the Balfour Declaration. Following the blacklisting of Hamas, the resistance movement reacted, saying in a statement that, instead of apologizing and correcting its historical sin against the Palestinian people, Britain supports the aggressors at the expense of the victims. It also added, resisting occupation by all available means, including armed resistance, is a right guaranteed by international law to people under occupation. Hamas also urged its supporters to condemn the UK's move, as it described Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands, forcible displacement of Palestinians, the demolition of their homes, and the siege of more than 2 million people in the Gaza Strip as terrorism.
Well, implicitly, I guess it's saying okay to Israeli crimes, but no different from they've been saying okay to Israeli crimes since 1917. So, in that sense, it's nothing new.
Based in Gaza, Hamas is a resistance group against Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. Hamas and Israel clashed most recently in a deadly asymmetrical war in May, during which the Israeli regime killed at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children, through its continuous bombardment of the Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
In the limelight.
Iran's President Sayyid Ebrahim Raisi says the Islamic Republic is absolutely serious in its pursuit of the removal of all U.S. illegal and cruel sanctions in the talks slated to be held later this month in Austria's capital, Vienna, on the fate of the troubled 2015 multilateral nuclear deal. We now present you an article written by Ali Rezo Karimi under the heading Why Iran Has the Right to be Strict in Vienna Talks. On 8th of May 2018, the world media broadcast a picture of then-US President Donald Trump signing an executive order, a decree that ended U.S.'s partnership in the nuclear deal between Iran and the 5+1 group of countries, the United Nations Security Council's 5 permanent members plus Germany. The agreement, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, had previously been considered by many countries and even by the Americans themselves the outcome of success of multilateralism in international relations. But U.S. President at the time, Donald Trump, annulled it with the stroke of a pen. Much of Iran's benefits in the accord were enshrined under U.S. commitments, but Iranians have always stressed that they were not properly implemented, even when the United States was a party to the JCPOA. However, the story of U.S. withdrawal from JCPOA did not end there. In addition to the restoration of previous sanctions and all-out expansion of restrictive measures under various labels, Washington blocked all parties that were seeking to implement UN Security Council Resolution 2231 by adhering to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Therefore, the United States demonstrated that it does not honor even a UN Security Council resolution which it had once voted for. On the other hand, the 3 European signatories to the JCPOA, France, Germany, and Britain, were unable or unwilling to take an effective action to fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA following the US pullout. Thus, their financial mechanism to engage with Iran, called INSTEX, did not work in practice. Nevertheless, Iran fully fulfilled its commitments under the JCPOA for a year after the US withdrawal from the agreement. Former U.S. President Donald Trump signed the executive order to withdraw from the JCPOA while, according to all International Atomic Energy Agency reports, Iran had fulfilled its obligations to the full and was under the strictest nuclear inspection and transparency regime. Tehran pursued the same path for a year after the U.S. pullout from the JCPOA, and again the IAEA reports confirmed again and again Iran's adherence to the agreement. During his election campaign, Donald Trump had called the JCPOA the worst deal in American history. Meanwhile, his friends in West Asia encouraged him to scrap the nuclear agreement with Iran, including Benjamin Netanyahu in the occupied Palestinian territories and Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. They, along with hardline U.S. senators such as Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton, who had undeniable anti-Iranian views, and John Bolton, a former U.S. National Security Advisor who later turned into Donald Trump's serious critic, paved the way for the United States to turn its back on its international commitments. Although the JCPOA was criticized by some politicians in Iran from the beginning for its imbalance of input and output, as well as its approach with regards to trusting the United States as a long-time enemy of the Islamic Revolution, the deal was respected and implemented as a decision of the then administration, and Tehran did not renounce it. Finally, 1 year after America's withdrawal, Iran began to reduce its nuclear commitments under the JCPOA. In Iran, a serious question on the minds of many people is, why is the country still honoring the deal, despite the U.S. pullout and the strict reimposition of sanctions, which have led to economic problems and the suffering of the nation? However, the Americans may not be aware that this reduction of commitments was precisely based on an article of the same agreement, i.e. Article 37. The article, approved by the UN Security Council as part of an annex to Resolution 2231, states, should sanctions be reimposed fully or partially, Iran will regard this as a ground for suspending all or part of its obligations under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Accordingly, Iran's right to reduce its commitments under the agreement has been recognized and approved by the UN Security Council in the event that sanctions are reimposed. The same declaration is also mentioned in Article 26 of the JCPOA itself. Thus, the picture projected by U.S. officials concerning the violation of the JCPOA is unrealistic. With the suspension of Iran's nuclear commitments, which took place gradually and in several steps, a series of developments in the United States eventually put a controversial end to Donald Trump's administration and brought Joe Biden to power. Joe Biden, who was himself the vice president under the government that had signed the JCPOA with Iran, called for a return to the accord. However, soon the Biden administration showed that it was in no hurry to do so and that a return to its commitments under the UN Security Council Resolution 2231 was essentially not a priority. As a result, Donald Trump's illegal and cruel sanctions against Iran have continued to this day. Negotiations were held between Iran and the 4+1 group, the remaining parties to the JCPOA, as the U.S. presence to review the resumption of the U.S. membership in the agreement. The talks continued for 6 rounds, but in practice they did not result in a U.S. return to the nuclear deal, as Washington refused to remove all sanctions imposed on Iran or to give the country a chance to verify the sanctions removal. With the elections in Iran and the government of President Said Ebrahim Raisi taking office, the Vienna talks were suspended for a short time and are scheduled to resume on 29th of November 2021. But what approach would Iran enter these negotiations with? Recently, the Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said the main goal pursued by Iran during the forthcoming talks with the remaining parties to the JCPOA is that Iran wants to secure removal of all illegal sanctions imposed on the country. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in a recent phone call with his Polish counterpart Zbigniew Rau, during which the two sides discussed bilateral relations as well as regional and international developments. During the phone call, Iran's top diplomat stressed the main goal pursued by Tehran through participation in the forthcoming talks in Vienna, Austria, is removal of all illegal sanctions imposed on Iran by the United States after the latter withdrew from the agreement in 2018. Hossein Amir Abdollahian added, all participants in Vienna talks have reached a common understanding that the United States is the main party to blame and is responsible for the current state of negotiations. After withdrawal from JCPOA, former U.S. President Donald Trump launched a maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic, which he claimed was aimed at compelling Iran into negotiating a new deal. In the latest developments surrounding this issue, Washington's Persian Gulf allies, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates welcomed the upcoming 7th round of Vienna talks and even called for an urgent mutual return to full compliance with the JCPOA, despite the fact that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, in addition to the Israeli regime, had cheered Donald Trump's withdrawal from the nuclear deal and his maximum pressure policy against Iran. Furthermore, Iran's president, Said Ebrahim Raisi, says, the Islamic Republic is absolutely serious in its pursuit of the removal of all U.S. sanctions in the talks slated to be held later this month in Vienna, Austria. In a phone call on Tuesday, 16th of November, with Russian President Vladimir Putin, whose country is also a party to the agreement, The Iranian president, Sayed Ebrahim Raisi, praised Moscow's position in defense of Iran's nuclear rights and the necessity of the removal of all sanctions imposed on the Islamic Republic by the United States. Sayed Ebrahim Raisi said, "The Islamic Republic of Iran is absolutely serious in the negotiations, and we are equally serious in ensuring the right of our nation to have the sanctions removed." It is almost clear that Iran's main purpose in participating in the talks is to remove all illegal U.S. sanctions, which have caused the suffering of the Iranian people. The Iranian government feels responsible to act if there is a possibility to remove the sanctions under fair conditions. On the other hand, Iran has repeatedly stressed that it is ready to return to its full obligations under the JCPOA whenever other parties meet their commitments and the sanctions removal is verified. However, Iran's experience shows that it cannot negotiate with a lenient approach towards the Americans. Washington easily violated UN Security Council Resolution 2231, reinstated and expanded sanctions against Iran, and even blocked Iran's access to medicine and food. Additionally, it carried out terrorist acts against Iran and martyred a senior Iranian military commander on the soil of a third country. Naturally, without verification and receiving necessary guarantees, no agreement can be reached with a country that has such a history. This is while the U.S. Republicans are vowing that they will once again violate the deal if they take helm of the U.S. executive branch of government. Moreover, the possibility of Donald Trump's return to power has become serious, given Joe Biden's poor performance and especially the debacle of U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. The question is, if Western politicians wanted to decide in a similar situation, would they be open to a new agreement and scaling back their nuclear programs without a guarantee? The answer to this question seems evident.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, the people, and the region as a whole. And as always, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss security dialogue on Afghanistan, hosted by New Delhi, which sought to evolve a pan-regional response to security challenges facing Afghanistan. And we shall look at the unfolding humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan, with millions of people on the brink of starvation, and how freezing of Afghan assets by the US has contributed to this disaster.
As Afghanistan continues to grapple with economic and humanitarian disasters, concerns regarding the rapidly deteriorating security situation have also assumed alarming proportions. That's what brought top regional security officials to New Delhi on November 10th to discuss the impact of the hasty US withdrawal and the stunning resurgence of Daesh in Afghanistan and the region. The participants sought to evolve a pan-regional response to security challenges facing the region and to pressurize the Taliban to form an inclusive government in Kabul.
Amidst the worsening humanitarian situation, Afghanistan has been rocked by a spate of terrorist attacks in recent weeks, sparking fresh concerns in the region. The resurgence of the Daesh terrorist group on the back of the US withdrawal from the country is particularly seen with great concern by Afghanistan's neighbors, including India and Iran. On November 10th, New Delhi convened a regional security conference on Afghanistan that saw the participation of top security officials from several regional countries. The objective was to evolve a pan-regional consensus on improving the regional security environment and to address fresh security challenges facing Afghanistan. The strongly worded declaration held complete unanimity between all eight participants in combating terrorism in all its forms and manifestations, and demanded an open and truly inclusive government that represents the will of the people of Afghanistan. It also suggested the formation of a regional coalition to push the Taliban on living up to its commitments. For India, Delhi dialogue was an attempt to reassert its regional leadership role, which apparently prompted China and Pakistan to skip the summit. While China cited scheduling difficulties, Pakistan criticized India as a spoiler. Taliban, which was not invited, welcomed the conference as being in the better interest of Afghanistan.
China and Pakistan, for different reasons, gave the New Delhi-hosted security summit a miss. And the US also stayed away, perhaps expecting an earful from other participants at the summit over its botched military adventure in Afghanistan. Iran's top security official, Rear Admiral Ali Shamkhani, who participated in the multilateral dialogue, minced no words in calling out the US for its disastrous military campaign in Afghanistan, its chaotic exit, the freezing of the country's assets, and paving the road for the resurgence of terrorist groups.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Rear Admiral Ali Shamkhani, represented the Islamic Republic at the Delhi Regional Security Dialogue on Afghanistan, making his country's position on security challenges facing Afghanistan and the region emphatically clear. He termed the US ouster from Afghanistan after 20 years of military occupation, marked by horrendous war crimes and human rights abuses, a disgraceful defeat. The US botched exit, he told participants at the summit, carried a lesson for others. He also slammed the US for freezing Afghanistan's assets and blamed Americans for the presence and expansion of terrorist groups like Daesh in the South Asian country. The top Iranian security official stressed that India has an important role in Afghanistan, while also acknowledging the role of other countries, including China and Pakistan. He also referred to humanitarian crisis facing the country and expressed Iran's readiness to help alleviate the sufferings of Afghans. Delhi Dialogue was a follow-up to the security summit hosted by Iran previously. An Iranian initiative, it seeks to streamline regional cooperation and collaboration against terrorist groups and their backers who seek to destabilize Afghanistan and the region at large.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Hossein Askari, Southwest Asia Coordinator at Schiller Institute. Now, Mr. Askari, first of all, welcome to the program. Now, how do you assess the geopolitical significance of the New Delhi Regional Security Conference on Afghanistan?
Hello to you and your audience on the program Subcontinent. It's a pleasure for me to be with you. Of course, any such a gathering concerning Afghanistan and the situation in Afghanistan, which is so urgent, is useful. But I think this Delhi Regional Dialogue this time, it's more symbolic than practical. The important thing is that the regional powers acknowledge the role of India as a key partner and player in the security and strategic matters of the region, and also the problem that the fact that the Taliban were not invited, and China and Pakistan declined to attend, that creates a certain setback. But I think as a symbolic move, it's very important, especially that the security officials of the countries around Pakistan are meeting, which gives it a different sense.
So did the dialogue hosted by India manage to evolve a unified pan-regional response to the war-ravaged countries' crises?
Well, not really. They are merely repeating what was said already in other such gatherings, especially the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summits. But, you know, I would like to comment on the final statement of certain points in the final statement of the Delhi Regional Dialogue, which I think are not right on the point. Point number two, it says that the suffering in Afghanistan is caused by the deteriorating security situation. It's not true. The humanitarian crisis and the difficulties are caused by the Western powers' blocking of Afghanistan's money, so Afghanistan cannot import food and medicine. And also the suffering is a result of 20 years of failures of the United States, of NATO, of the EU, Australia, and all their allies in building an economy, a resilient economy in Afghanistan, to be able to produce food, to provide simple services and so on. Point seven of the declaration says that it's calling for an open and truly inclusive government. This rhetoric is being repeated in every meeting by everybody. I don't think this is an important point. The story is that there is a government in Afghanistan. Of course, it didn't come through elections, but de facto, there is a government in Afghanistan. What is important to do now is to stabilize the situation in Afghanistan and cooperate with Taliban to first end this humanitarian crisis, stabilize the situation, but at the same time demand that Taliban first respect the rights of the minorities, other minorities and groups, ethnic groups in Afghanistan, and two, they should immediately start a reconciliation and national dialogue to plan for the coming period.
Now, Mr. Askari, do you think the summit attended by top security officials was an attempt by India to prove its relevance as a key regional player?
Look, India is a very important country. It's a relevant country, and it has played an important historical role through the years. But it seems to me that India is suffering, under the current leadership, is suffering from some sort of an identity crisis, because it has one foot in Asia, but it wants to have the other foot in the Atlantic region. It is, you know, it's like it has, it wants to be part of the Western alliance to limit and encircle China, which is not a conductive policy. It has gone against the Belt and Road Initiative, which every country in the region, including Afghanistan, say that this is important for Afghanistan and for all, the whole region, to stabilize, to rebuild the economy, and bring prosperity and security in the whole region. So India, since 2001, India did great things in Afghanistan. They built the hydropower, they built the road they built the electricity grid from Uzbekistan to Kabul to provide the electricity. They built the 200-kilometer road from Zaranj to Delaram on the Iranian border, and the Chabahar road. So therefore, they have to continue doing these things. They provided wheat, hundreds of thousands of tons of wheat. They should continue doing this kind of work, but not under the leadership of the Atlantic Alliance, but in cooperation with the neighboring countries.
Mr. Askari, China and Pakistan notably skipped the New Delhi summit for different reasons. So why are there clashing visions on Afghanistan's future between these two countries and India?
Yeah, I think that, first of all, India, Pakistan, China, and the other countries, they should throw away the idea of geopolitics. This is a product of the British Empire. It's a British concoction. All the problems in the region go back historically to the British Empire. The Kashmir problem was created by the British Empire. The Afghanistan problems have been created by the British Empire. And therefore, we should leave India and Pakistan and China, all these countries, they should move from geopolitics to geoeconomics, because it's very important for India, Pakistan, China, Iran, and others, and Afghanistan to build economic ties. And there should go ahead and build the Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline. They should at the same time connect the Iran, Pakistan, India gas pipeline. They should start there. They should not wait to solve all the old historical political problems, but they should start with normalization of relations by connecting the countries of the region with infrastructure, roads, electricity, gas pipelines, oil pipelines, water management systems. This is what our Schiller Institute is calling for. We just had a conference in the United States where we both called for the unfreezing of the money of Afghanistan, but also to help integrate Afghanistan into the Belt and Road Initiative, the New Silk Road, and that all countries, including India, should be part of that, with Iran, with the Central Asian nations, and Russia, and so on and so forth.
Mr. Askari, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Dmitry Solodov, a spokesperson for Russian Embassy in New Delhi, expresses gratitude to India for hosting the security summit on Afghanistan and says Russia's stance is in line with Delhi declaration. Indian journalist and author Stanley Johnny notes that New Delhi lacks the clout to influence or oppose Taliban, so it has to work with Russia and Iran, the two key players who want stability in Afghanistan. Sushmit Patil, an international affairs analyst, quotes Iran's top security official, Rear Admiral Ali Shamkhani, saying that the U.S. must pay reparation to people of Afghanistan for the 20-year military occupation.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
People in war-ravaged Afghanistan have been tormented by grinding poverty and hunger for decades. But since the botched exit of the US-led international forces and the sweeping takeover of the Taliban 3 months ago, the country has been teetering on the brink of a major humanitarian catastrophe. UN agencies have already sounded alarm bells, warning that millions of Afghans could run out of food before the onset of the upcoming harsh winter, as well as around 1 million children being at the risk of starvation and death.
That 20 years of foreign military occupation brought nothing but misery and despondency to the people in Afghanistan is clearly evident now. 3 months after the US-led coalition hastily abandoned the country, millions of Afghans are on the brink of starvation, with no food and no money. Parallels are already being drawn between Afghanistan and Yemen, the two strategically located, mineral-rich countries plundered and destroyed by foreign aggressors.
Afghanistan, almost 23 million people are marching towards starvation, 8.7 million on famine's door. 95% of the people don't have enough food. It's a crisis. It's a catastrophe.
With nearly the entire population teetering on the brink of grinding poverty, global humanitarian watchdogs are sounding the alarm over the likelihood of mass starvation across Afghanistan. A top official of the UN World Food Programme has termed it the worst humanitarian crisis on Earth, while a senior executive of the UN Development Programme has described it as the worst humanitarian disaster he has ever seen. These statements point to the gravity and magnitude of the unfolding crisis, with about 97% of the 38 million population sinking into an abyss of poverty. Among those at risk include 4 million children under 5 who are staring at severe malnutrition. And worse, tens of thousands of people are getting displaced. The Norwegian Refugee Council this week reported that up to 300,000 Afghans have made their way to Iran since August, fleeing poverty and death.
Afghanistan did not plunge into this crisis situation overnight. It has been in the making for decades, essentially manufactured by the foreign powers that invaded the country in October 2001 and patronized and funded militia groups in decades before that. This policy hasn't changed a bit. Having left the country, the US government has now found a novel way to strangulate poor Afghans by freezing their assets and blocking international aid while issuing statements of concern over the unfolding crisis in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan was already battling drought and a large number of Afghans were already vulnerable to food crisis before the Taliban led a sweeping takeover of the country in August. But the impending famine is the direct result of the chaotic withdrawal of US-led international coalition forces. Even the New York Times, which has effectively played its role as the devil's advocate, recently admitted that the crisis in Afghanistan was in large part American-made, fueled by deliberate policy choices with results that were predicted months in advance. Soon after the Taliban laid siege to Kabul mid-August, US and its international partners raced to cut off Afghanistan's access to international aid and froze roughly $10 billion in assets belonging to the country's central bank. The move triggered the rapid collapse of public finances and precipitated the current crisis. European Union also then followed the suit, stopping development assistance to the country, followed by the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. Calls are growing for the US to unfreeze funds that has led to the collapse of Afghanistan's domestic economy, even as 38 million Afghans stare at death and starvation with the onset of harsh winter. Human rights activists say statements of concern won't suffice. Real action and practical steps would.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mrs. Tara Rayner O'Grady, Secretary General of Human Rights Sentinel. Now, Mrs. O'Grady, welcome to the program. First of all, Afghanistan is teetering on the brink of a worst humanitarian catastrophe with millions without food. So what should the international community be doing to avert the impending crisis?
Thank you for having me join your show. I'm very honored to be here and for my voice to be included in this discussion on Afghanistan.
I believe Afghanistan was effectively hijacked as an entire country and administered by external interests who ensured through military intervention that resources continued to flow through and out of the country. It may not be possible to completely avert the crisis the people face this season, but it could be effectively managed in partnership with those approved international NGOs who need safe access to the country and who seek to alleviate the existing suffering and who can hopefully assist with improving relations within the community through consistent communication and cooperation with the Taliban authorities to ensure that adequate food, medicine and fuel reaches those who are the most vulnerable and who are already struggling.
Now, do you think it was the US or the US-led coalition that paved the way